This is KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, it's available at www.givemesometruth.info. And tonight, I've got a special guest, Linda Runyon. And I don't have a bio that I would like to give. I'd like to let you describe yourself a little bit because...
Oh, my.
Because you talk a little bit about, you know, what you've done, but, you know, I think it's better to hear it out of the mouth of the person that's experienced it all. So go ahead, Linda.
Okay. Well, gee, Melody, is so eclectic as far as... I'm 73 years old, and... I am a person who is very fortunate to have an experience to go into the woods back in 70 and live off the land entirely with no, fixtures or nothing but an outhouse, no electricity or anything. For, I guess it was about 14 years in the upper Adirondack Mountains. And then... got the call to help to take care of my mother and father out in Phoenix, Arizona, and went out and lived in my first apartment off the desert for another 13 years. And survival in the woods and survival in intense heat is pretty much the same in how – there's no way to describe it, but we folks who have done these kind of odd things can tell you that survival is survival, no matter where you are, and it's a gear that you are in touch with yourself and do the very best you can for yourself. And I truly believe that's when you're most in touch with yourself, in touch with God, as you will. And anyway, I'm very fortunate because I was able to live that and was able to then go out west and do approximately the same thing coming back into the system.
Now,
so that's, I'm a nurse, and that helped me a lot, you know, to be organized, Melody, and to, well, I said, you know, when all this was going on, I'm going to write all this down because, I mean, I'm an organizer type person, and, you know, it worked for me now in my age to pay the rent where I am because I've written a lot of books and such, and I know you'll probably mention our website.
Well, you go ahead and tell us, because you...
Well, it's ofthefield.com, and it's just the word ofthefield.com, and I would never have such a thing. I would never have a computer in the house, believe me, but my oldest boy... convinced me that for me to get the word out for what I am trying to say, that I was going to have to learn technology. And I'm telling you, I'm as proud of that today as I was the other things. It's to me just amazing, the technology that we have, like we're talking now, and other people will hear this. I mean, this is we lived where we had 3 visitors in 1 year. If you can imagine that. And that was how I thought in my mind. And when I went to Phoenix, there were 6 million people when I first went. I think there's over 8.5 or 9 million now. And I would tell you, that was pure unadulterated survival, getting in a car and driving to a 4 or 6 crossroad light and going across. I mean, it was do or die, really. So it was like it was survival. I mean, I could go on for hours about what I feel survival is. And we're undergoing as people right now, learning more and more and more as our way of life is in jeopardy a little bit.
Why don't you tell us what you offer on that website?
Well, if I can help, it's on the website are the books I've written. The first one when I came out of the woods was Survival Acre, which is a field guide, which is pretty much absorbed in the new one. The new one's the Essential Wild Food Field Guide, and that took 26 years to write. And it in my mind says it all food-wise. I mean, I'm not a nutritionist or an herbalist, Melody. I'm a wild food expert. I mean, I look out the window now and I see maybe 10 foods in front of me. I see trees as everything from tea to soup, you know, the edible trees. All this, it took me the last 30 years or more to get it together. So on that website is, my son has done the website and he's done all the marketing here, and without that I could never be talking to you. I'm trying to show, but through a DVD and a deck of cards, which is with the a lot of the military outlets in the country too. I'm trying to show how you can, within days, completely live off the land where you stand. Now, this is food-wise. This
right.
has nothing to do with, shelter or, most important, water, you know. This is food-wise. Food-wise, you've got everything you need. You're walking on it. On the website, I talk about all sorts of things. There's letters that will tell you that, like in Iraq, every time I see newsreels, all I see is food. I see what I'm eating off my backyard here. I'm seeing the soldiers wading through in Afghanistan, wading through. I mean, I hear talk of, worrying about changing farmers' poppy seeds or whatever. My Lord, there's every kind of thing imaginable, and it's all free. It's all there. On the website, I talk about all sorts of things in the past that have happened. People ask me, even had the Department of Agriculture ask me in Arizona which product I thought would be the most growing, you know. And I said, tumbleweed. Tumbleweed makes the best darn muffins you've ever eaten.
Really?
I mean, yeah, they're delicious. They're sweet and there's material out on that, and there's material out on anything at all in what I've written for anywhere you are. It doesn't make any difference what country, because that's what worried me as a nurse, being organized. I didn't want to say it was just Colorado. I love Colorado. I've been there several times for the survival expos down there in Denver, and I was thrilled to find everything on in my books and cards in Boulder without a problem. I mean, you're talking within a couple hundred yards. You can see, where people have mowed the lawn. They have all the same plants. I know I'm getting kind of wild here for the first listeners, but when you mow your lawn, you're mowing about 10 or 12 major foods. So Melody, my premise was, how fast can they grow, you know? And you get upset because you got to do it every 2 weeks, right? Well, in that length of time, you have a food field that just grew again.
Yeah, and unless
people just let 2 feet grow. If you let 2 feet make a ribbon with your rototill, you've got a field that can't be a fire hazard. It can't be all the things that come along over the years.
Well, I just got back from a Living Foods program, an Ann Wigmore program.
Yeah, I'm Ann Wigmore's early times. I remember her. Yes, I sure do.
And the Susan that runs the program there is just going ravenously across her ground, picking through the different wild growing plants, and then she's adding her own too, but.
Right.
It's just amazing when you start going out in what
it's
looks like.
It's a whole world. It is the world, the way we really live in. You know, I mean, it's everything else is man-made.
Right, and I had land that I worked, for about 10 years that's very similar to what she's working, in the New Mexico high desert there, and it's amazing how much grows.
It's abundance. It's everything we're told in our scriptures that is there. It's total abundance everywhere you look. It's something that hasn't diminished. It's gotten more as we try and get rid of the wild food and whatever. Weeds is another word for it. These weeds have grown now in every dirt spot, which has made it like laughable, it's harder and harder and harder to get rid of them. But that's just the abundance that I believe has been given to us. I've always believed this, even before I went in the woods. I mean, I didn't eat these things before. Well, actually, that's not true. I as a child, drove my mother crazy picking on the lawn all the time and eating things. I opened one of the books with Linda. What was it? Linda, don't eat the lawn or something like that. I opened one of the chapters. Because it was constant to yell. Because I knew it was food.
Well,
I mean, we're taught not to eat the things that we're walking on.
Well, it's now that I'm working with wheatgrass, it.
Oh, my gosh. Victoria Kavalkas, I knew him. I did workshops with him years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. When he very first started in New York, the town of Indian Lake got together. Oh my gosh, you just opened up things I hadn't thought of in years. They took a collection up and sent me in to it. It was a food, what was it called? I guess it was a health food show. It was like 3 days long,
mm-hmm.
and it was over 2 million people, and I can't remember which skyscraper it was in, but it was immense. Oh my goodness sakes. And I was completely lost, except that I was fed by four people. I was fed by the Hare Krishnas who were giving out this wonderful raisin cake that kept stamina in me. And then I found Stephen Brill, and Stephen Brill was starting then, and he's now the Wowie and Brill in New York. And he takes lectures through the Central Park. And he had a salad, a great big giant wild salad that he kept going and handed people out samples. Well, they just gave me bowls of stuff, and that kept me going with energy because I walked the whole 3 days, and I didn't have a booth. I was all by myself, and what I had was probably about 5,000 flyers, which were gone in the first day. I saved one, and somebody said, you have to have more, and I remember that. I remember they took it to some office somewhere, and, you know, I mean, I was living practically, we had just gotten a cabin that we had a floor. I mean, we had dirt floors there for a long time. Lived in a tent for 6 or 8 months type thing, and there I was in the middle of New York. It was like, wow. So they helped me. It was wonderful. The people were fantastic.
What was the town that you lived in the Anirondack, or nearest town anyways?
Nearest big town. Up above me was Blue Mountain Lake, which has the New York State Museum in it. And down below me, 2 hours down, was Lake George.
Okay, so...
And the nearest hospital was 60 miles away. That was Glens Falls.
Okay, so what part of the state would that be
up,
in?
We just say upstate. It's if you took the New York Thruway, it's upstate. If you kept going an hour and a half, 2 hours up, you'd end up in Canada.
Okay, all right.
So... and if you go an hour and a half off the thruway to the right, you'd end up in Vermont.
Okay, because, I mean, you did mention Ithaca in one
part. Oh, yeah, that's to the left.
Okay.
Yep, my son is up in Syracuse.
Okay.
Yep.
So how did these guys find out about you at this conference?
Well, they didn't. That's what the town did. They got the money up for me to go in and stay 3 days and come home. And that was the thing, that I should show them this flyer. And on it, I said something about we're walking on our food. And I have copies of all this stuff all put away. My kids use it from time to time on the website. I wrote up something like everything we need for food is we're walking on it. And I don't know, it was a very primitive type thing that I wrote down. It wasn't even typed. It was written and then Xeroxed. And I'm telling you, it was unbelievable. I had a post office box in one of the little towns up there, Indian Lake. And that post office box just was jammed with letters. I had to answer them all by hand, of course, and I had no phone. And it started like that and went on like that for quite a while.
And what period of time was this?
I'm trying to remember. I was still in my log cabin and everything. So it was, 72, 82. It must have been around 82.
82?
Something like that, yeah. Yes, because People Magazine found me.
Oh.
In 82. and did, or yes, 82, and did a three-page article. They lived with me for 10 days, and that just blew it out of proportion. I didn't even know how to, I refused everything, Melody. I refused a cook show, do you believe it, in New York, to be like the wild Martha Stewart they were calling me or something. Yeah, right. Well, I had bum shoulders from cutting wood so much from so many cords of wood here. Seriously, I wouldn't have done that because the only pots I would use was iron. I wouldn't use any other kind of pot, you know. And I knew that a cook show would what that would do. It would just wear you right to the bone and nothing flat. I knew that much. So I said no to everything. I said no to all sorts of radio shows and television. Once I said yes, and that was when I was feeling a little bit more confident, and it was to Linda Dano, Lifetime Cable, uh-huh. in Brooklyn. And I went in and did that. Yep, that was a lot of fun. I hauled like 6 coolers of food and crabgrass muffins, crackers, and oh my gosh, I'm just remembering all that. That was a lot of fun. What? And those are the days when in the audience, I was up like 2 days in the hotel washing thyme, T-H-Y-M-A, which always is like a peppery, you know, herb that you could taste. Uh-huh. And I washed it in the sink in the big hotel they put me in. And I did that over and over to be sure there wasn't a grain of sand or dirt on anything. And we actually handed that out to the audience. And you can imagine today, in just this short period of time, in 10 or 15 years, what would happen if we put herb out in the audience. I truly believe that all those things that have happened to me uh-huh. have led to something better.
Well,
I truly believe that.
Well,
and
I'm not any different. And sometimes when I have those accidents, I have to kind of sit back and reflect now, okay, what's going on around me that might have contributed to this? So.
Yep, me too. And I try not to overanalyze this if it's to the point now where all these little details and everything are getting in our way of actually doing for ourselves. I truly believe that. I truly believe that's happening. You can't keep up with it anyway. I mean, people my age around me here, we talk about a lot of stuff, but when we actually start reflecting on things, we just sort of like scratch our heads and go, we can't go there. It's just too much. I don't envy the young kids today, but I do see that they're extremely aware of the young folks. And they're listening to the things that some of us are saying. A lot of my wild food teachers are doing very, very well because the young kids are seeing that the earth is, you know, I don't like to go political, but when you hear that everything that has been eaten for 30,000 years, okay, all the way back to caveman time, and then you have the Native Americans, and you have Christopher Columbus in Europe that brought a lot of these plants over here. They brought a lot of the plants I eat over here. The things like the dandelion were not here.
Really?
Yeah.
Whoa.
There's a whole book out on what's native and what isn't. They actually brought them, the settlers. I did an article on that once. I can't remember which ones precisely. Some of them I do. But all the plants I use are the ones that are here, right? But they weren't all here. At least 11 or 12 of them were brought here for food.
Interesting.
And they were not here for Native Americans. You won't find them in any of the resources, the history.
Where did you go to research a lot of that?
Every direction. I'm serious. The Chippewa up on the Great Lakes, they did a pharmacopoeia, which goes all the way back to, I don't know, 1800 or something. And the information has been gathered. And when I say that 6 inches of weeping willow equal six inches now of any willow, weeping willow or wild willow tree, pussy willow even, that 6 inches, catkins, leaves, everything, equal approximately 2 aspirin.
Huh.
That's a fact. There is acetylsalicylic acid. And when you go in the health food shop, you buy willow prin, which was the easiest, I guess, to over Pussy Willow, or and Wild Willow is questionable at times because it likes to pull up acid out of a swamp, you know. So you don't want that over a Weeping Willow. Let's see if you had the two.
Yeah, because you said something about the pink color being an indicator.
Yeah, that's the nitrates, yep.
Okay.
They're actually nitrates. They're actually pesticides, not pesticides. They're actually preservatives that are found in our food. Our food has preservatives, and I'm not a total expert on this, but I know pretty much they're about the same. And the preservatives were found to be things that made something last longer. And, of course, you would put that in whatever. Well, your swamp has a lot of salt out in the desert, a lot of desert salt in swamps. And I taught out there in Arizona there for 13 years, and I told them, do not eat the willow if it's got pink inside. You strip the bark, and you look, just look at it. And if it's pinkish, don't eat it. Don't use it as a... You have to find a part of it or a part of the tree that was growing on the bank, for instance, that didn't turn pink. It didn't pull up that heavy-duty acid in the water.
What part of Arizona were you in?
What's that?
What part of Arizona were you in?
I was in Glendale.
Glendale, and that's?
Maricopa County, which has a lot of the news today.
Okay, yes. So but you didn't live primitive?
I lived in apartments. Over seven or eight of them, going closer and closer to where my mother was passing on, and my father. I took care of them in a very fancy Sun City West out there,
uh-huh.
And I kept moving closer constantly. I was way on the other side of the valley in the beginning, and then I moved closer and closer and closer up Grand Avenue to different apartments, and until I ended up actually in Sun City West the last 2 years before they passed on.
Okay, so how did you practice your desert?
I went out.
Okay.
I went out all the time. I I didn't even have a cell phone. That's a good thing, because nobody bothered me. I mean, seriously, I looked at it like that. If I was interrupted from being, and I still am like that, if I'm gathering food for myself, that part of my survival kicks in, right? I needed enough, let's say, to teach classes for the next month of, let's say, Palo Verde beans. Or let's say mesquite beans, for instance. They grow on trees out there.
Uh-huh.
And I would plan my day, and I'd plan it to the heat, and I'd go way early in the morning, and I'd be coated in the highest SPF of sun tan lotion I could put on. That was survival to me. I couldn't do it. I'm blonde. I could not do it if I hadn't thought all those things out. And I did. I thought them all out and went out there for the day and took water, lots and lots of water. And I ate whatever I was picking. So the Palo Verde beans, I'd eat a handful of them and then put a sheet, for instance, around that tree. And I'd work straight for like 45 minutes. And, anyway, I would have enough. When I got back, I couldn't even drag the sheets sometimes, or skip, especially mesquite beans, because they were so long and quite heavy if you get a ton of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'd drag them back to the car. And the first thing I learned was don't ever put them in the car, because there's enough little stinging ants in those things to kill you by the time you drove home. So survival-wise, it was like learning about the black flies in the Adirondacks, which after a while I got used to. I never did get used to a nest of ants, though. They're really severe. And the killer bees that came along, they were tough to get used to, too. That's why I stopped. I stopped taking groups of people. We took as many as 100 at a clip out there.
Wow.
I stopped because I learned enough to know that they send their scouts ahead. And if you saw these little black, smaller than normal bumblebees, and there they were all of a sudden in front of you on something,
uh-huh.
And then you wouldn't see one, you know. Oh, look, there's another one. Oh, look, one just went by me. That was time to get back to your cars as fast as you could. And we did that.
So they have
doctors, lawyers, everybody out there. And I would say, we're leaving. And they would go, oh, no, we're really enjoying this. No, we're going now because the killer bees have found us. And, you know, anyone in Arizona will tell you that that was the sign. Those little scouts that they sent ahead was time to leave.
Hmm.
Yeah. It was the same thing with Puma. We would have Puma come into camps where we were working, like in Rivas Mountain Survival School out there. And when the Puma came in to investigate what we were doing, and I started seeing tracks, especially ahead of us, because if I saw those tracks ahead of me, then I knew they were already up there and they were sort of like playing with us, waiting for us to come in the canyon. And we would leave. And people would get all upset. I'd show them the footprints and tell them why we're leaving. But that was the end of the hour and a half.
Hmm.
I'm rambling.
Well, you know, I've run across those tracks when I go out walking in my area, because I'm in the middle of mountains where I live.
Right.
And so, but
if
I'd never...
If they're ahead of you all the time, you've got a problem. By ahead of you, I mean we had a group of people, and then we were making noise.
You know,
so,
I...
Yeah, and if I saw fresh tracks, you're talking fresh tracks now.
Uh-huh.
The animal's playing with you. I had one follow me for, maybe 4 or 5 miles when I walked from a small town and to another area. And I write about this. This is in my homestead memories.
Okay.
What I did was pick out not horrible things, because nobody wants to read that, but I picked out things that were, I remembered that told me something about actual survival and living off the land and stuff. And that was one of them. And she started out by showing her tracks to me in front of me. And then I was kind of wary because I knew it was a big cat. And then after a while, I heard a twig snap behind me, which was unusual. And it was her. And she was up on the bank behind me. And you know what? She just followed me all the way home.
Huh.
She didn't do anything. I became the way we became there with the bears and stuff. It was like you're really one with them, you know. If you walk in the woods, you know how you get and how they get more birds around you when you're more acclimated to where you are.
You know, you said you got large groups that seem to show an interest. Now, what was going on that was creating that kind of interest? Why were people coming to your walks and that sort? What was their motive behind it, or did they have just various...
There's always been, since I came out of the woods in, let's say, when People Magazine found me in 82, seems so 2 or 3% of people now, and I'm saying this with I really think it's breath, so have always been interested in learning more for many different reasons about their environment. I did a lot of scouts. I did a lot of, you know, people who work outside. But survival-wise, there's probably 2, 3, 4% always interested in knowing more and more about the now, where they're standing, what they would do if, you know, always been a lot of people like that. Way before we had financial problems. And I've always fit in that group since I was a baby. I mean, eating the lawn all the time must have been, because I was well fed. Right? Somebody said, maybe you have some Neanderthal in you. Well, nothing in the world would make me happier to know that. If they ever got a test like that, you know, it would make me so happy to know that genetically that kind of thinking comes down the pike, you know.
Well, I noticed that you mentioned a Native American person in some of your work. Was this from Arizona?
My very best person that taught me all about the desert is Willie Whitefeather. Willie Whitefeather is a Cherokee storyteller, extremely psychic gentleman that found me, came across me on some walk I did. And he heard that I was going to, and he came on the walk. And that and his friend Peter Bigfoot in Rivas Mountain Survival School also came to my apartment, first apartment I had, and wanted to know what I was about, were the words. And it didn't take very long for us to realize that we all had something very much in common.
So,
Willie is in a five-sided yurt that he built on the top of one of the mountains in Oregon. And he built it and lives all by himself. I really admire the gentleman because he's kept his, he's walking the walk,
mm-hmm.
you know, walking the talk. He's, I've gone back to what I call pure luxury, you know, and yet I'm more at home if I'm very dirty and pulling up food out there to do some small lecture or for myself. I put a lot up in the freezer now and dry a lot. So I always have many weeks and months ahead.
Well, do you have any books that are on your desert work? Or what I was looking at was primarily when you first started. And
mm-hmm. When I first started, I'm trying to remember because, of course, my mom was my focus. I had to make a living, pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first started, I had just the Survival Acre. And I had my deck of cards, Melody. Yeah, that's right. Arizona didn't seriously trust me because there were no cactus on that deck of cards.
Oh.
And I actually probably over the years have had a lot of people help me on and off, and I have put several hundred thousands of dollars into my work. I've always kept it going, no matter what. And, yeah, I'm just remembering that. I had to borrow, it cost like $400 and some per card, laminated card to make, to change it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I took Fiddlehead Fern out because Fiddlehead Fern had been put out there in the news as carcinogenic. And, of course, it's actually ridiculous because in Japan they eat, as I ate, a quart and a half of something. So if you eat a quart and a half of Fiddlehead Ferns with the tannin in it a day, let's say, that's too much tannin. So you would get stomach ulcers, you know. And it's not that wild food caused it. It's that you were eating too much of one plant that has something in it, way too much of it. Say, for instance, you ate too much Curly Dock right now. If you ate every day Curly Dock, let's say, a quart of it,
mm-hmm.
And some, and I will say some macrobiotic people were doing this before I started lecturing, and I don't know if I've helped in changing that or not, but I did do a lot of lectures up Syracuse Ithaca way on that because it has so much vitamin A in it, and that's stored in the liver, and you can't get rid of it once you have it. In other words, I would lecture how good Curly Dock was for anyone who liked to heal their liver from alcohol abuse. Well, gosh, you can't just say that, say. And the point is that if you were to eat it every day, which people have done every day, if you say something like that, they're actually overdoing, and they're storing that particular vitamin in the liver. It's not excreted.
Okay.
It's not, it isn't. As I say, I'm not a nutritionist, but these are facts. That, you know, it's not excreted out of the body. If you were to take a whole bottle of vitamins, most of them are excreted out of the body. But vitamin A is going to go right to your liver and stay there. So you get real sluggish. You can hardly put one foot in front of the other if you're eating too much of it.
One of them, you said something about horsetail not being as a poisonous.
Yes, I use that as a poison for all the reasons. Only the plants that I knew over the 26 years out there, totally, only the plants that I knew did not produce anything but great energy and whatever. I don't put anything in my card decks or anything that you have to be careful of. You got to be careful of handling nettle just to handle it, you know. But you can eat all you want of it.
Uh-huh.
You can eat all you want of all the plants in there except when it says caution, don't eat more than half a cup or a cup to start with type thing.
Okay.
If I were to put horsetail in there, or put a lot of the herbs that are used today, but they're used in small amounts. Not the way my people. The people that I teach are people that have a bowl, a bunch of leaves, and a spoon, and that's it. There's no thought, you know, if this is a survival thing. There's no thought to, I can only eat a quarter cup of this, or I can only eat a half cup of this. So it's been hard to sift it all out, and as a nurse, I got the right help from the right people. Dr. Duke helped me a great deal with the nutrition information
mm-hmm.
in that book. Without it, I couldn't have printed any statement. that's USDA requirements that are put on those plants. And
well, I once gathered a bunch of horsetail and made a lot of tea. I made a lot of tea out of it, and I never felt a thing, so I don't know.
A tea would be fine because of the small being a small amount, but I make it hard and fast, don't eat it. It's just I'm so used to people. Let me see if I can explain this. When I have like a man in the class who hears he can eat all the Malva neglecta, you know, which is out west everywhere right now, it's growing everywhere.
Is that also mallow?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's grown real high. They'll hear from me. I might make a statement, which is a bit carried away by saying you can eat all you want of it. Well, not so, because what they'll do is eat 4 quarts of the stuff. No, I'm not fooling.
I believe it.
One time he said, my God, he said, I'm not sick, but I feel like I've had 4 Thanksgiving dinners. And I said, well, how much did you eat? He said, oh, probably about 1.5 quarts. Do you know what's in that, Malva, 1/2 cup? I mean, if you look it up, let me look it up in my book here. If you look it up in the Malva section, he did eat 4 or 5 Thanksgiving dinners and then some, because this is 1/2 cup, these equivalents in the book, in the Essential Field Guide.
Uh-huh.
28 calories is all you get in 1/2 cup of this leaf, right?
Okay.
But you get 3.6 grams of protein. Well, you eat 1.5 quarts, so you've had your protein for the day. Calcium, you get almost a 6-ounce glass of milk. You eat 1.5 quarts, you've had 5 glasses of milk. And so on. You go down to the beta carotene. That's good. 3,315 units of beta carotene. But look at the niacin, 500 units of niacin. Well, good heavens, he ate, and this is 1/2 cup now, he ate like 1.5 quarts. Well, good heavens, his system has to process all that. And it's no wonder he felt flush. That was probably the niacin. And he felt like he had eaten, you know, so many Thanksgiving dinners, because his whole system had to pull out all that goodness out of that food. So, as a person teaching this, I tell people start out with 1/2 cup and work your way. I mean, if the statement says you can eat all you want of this in the field guide, it won't say that until after it's said, you know, eat 1/2 cup and, you know, go slow and test your, you know, most people can eat a large amount of wild lettuce, let's say. Well, wild lettuce has, probably about 15, 20 leaves on it that are got this little mild infusion of milk in each of the leaves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one I think the Bible's speaking about in many portions when they say that wild lettuce, eat ye the herbs of the field, the bitter herbs. We feel it's chicory and wild lettuce. I mean, most of us do, are the people who teach this.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's all over that area, as is most desert areas. And so we eat wild lettuce. I picked some for tonight, actually, and I've got like maybe 6 or 7 leaves in there. That's going to be enough because they run a bit bitter, but then if you look up wild lettuce and look at it to a head of lettuce, it's a joke. I mean, seriously, a head of lettuce will have a whole lot of fiber and some minerals. Wild lettuce leaves will have, this is 1/2 cup now, 18 calories, 1,000 units of beta carotene, 400 in niacin, potassium 264 milligrams. I'm trying to see anything it's outlandish in. Nothing. It's pretty much regular and normal. But this is 10 or 15 leaves, not even that many, maybe 6 or 7. They're big leaves. 6 or 7 leaves make 1/2 cup.
So do you put...
If you make 1 quart out of that, ate 1 quart of wild lettuce salad, it would be so much energy, you'd be popping.
Now, you do put recipes in...
Yes.
In your book.
Oh, yes, yes. And Melody, you should know that the recipes are coded. It tells you they're coded. Some are students' recipes. Some are my old homestead recipes, and you pretty much can tell them because I just took it and put it in water or I mean, I didn't have anything fancy to put in there.
Mm-hmm.
I would have, you know, mine, I'm trying to find an example here. Mine would be simple nettle soup, okay, 3 cups of leaves of nettle, washed and sliced, any part of the, 4 cups of water. Now, I put 2 tablespoons of butter in this recipe, but I didn't own butter. I didn't own milk. I had a goat, and we tried making milk and butter. I mean, making the butter, and it did just didn't work well enough for us.
Uh-huh.
We drank milk, but that was it. And my recipe has just some salt or Queen Anne's lace seeds. Now, Queen Anne's lace is something that, you know, this is a long show, and I could go into great detail between Queen Anne's lace and poison hemlock, but I'm just going to say straight out, get some of the material, either the Essential Wild Food Fuel Guide or the DVD or the deck of cards, and it will give you all those differences, especially the book, between a lookalike, which is poison hemlock, and Queen Anne's lace. Queen Anne's lace, we all know, our fields here are filled with it. And then maybe in a whole 3 acres, there might be one poison hemlock plant that you can't see. Well, you can't take a chance with that. That's your deadly. That's your real bad one. So you have to know that the food of the wild carrot or Queen Anne's lace has fuzz on the stem. And that fuzz, my students get so used to feeling, the first thing they're going to do is take their fingers and rub it down the stalk. That's the first thing they're going to do. If it's got the fuzz, you don't have the queen. You don't have the deadly.
Now, you do classes then? Is that what you're
no,
saying?
No, that's why I did all my things. All your wild food teachers will teach you all this, but I chose really to in my later years now, to do videos, DVDs, things like this.
Okay.
And the 6 books. And I have an 8th book halfway done, which I hope to get out sometime in the next couple years.
And how many cards are in this deck of cards?
52.
52? Oh,
yeah.
So
actually, there's 50. Actually, Melody, is 55 because okay. There's one. Yeah, there's a card on, you know, what's in there. And then there's another card on the foraging rules, and they're real important.
Okay.
The foraging rules.
When I was going through your guide, I was surprised at how many things grow out here. Was that a mixture between the desert and the Adirondack area, or was that
these plants you're looking at everywhere you are?
Okay,
I found them literally in the top of mountains, and I found them down in valleys and on the desert and on in you know.
Uh-huh.
Wherever. So it and you know, I don't go just by me because I didn't go everywhere. I go mostly by the Department of Agriculture, and they have that information where the plants are found.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so that little map on my cards, there's a little map, and if the map is clouded all the way over, that means it's everywhere from Canada all the way down to, you know. And then since then, I've gotten books like Sturtevant's Wild Foods of the World type thing. And I've done a lot of research in that area so that when I say on a radio show or whatever, if I say that it's worldwide, I'm not only Sturtevant says it is, but you can even go on USDA.gov and you can punch in the name of a plant,
mm-hmm.
and it'll give you lots of information on it.
Oh, okay, that's great.
That's our government gives us lots of.
Now, do they have good pictures there?
Yes, excellent pictures.
Okay.
Yep, very good pictures. And there's two books out which I since have gotten since I wrote all mine. There's two books that are like Bibles to me. It doesn't say something's edible. That's the only thing. But when people buy them, they have send them to me, and I'll pay me a couple of dollars for the hour or two it's going to take me. I take a red magic marker and I make a dot on the ones that are the chapters or the ones that are food.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest of them are not. And when I go on a walk, people will say, what is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? Well, there's only 2,000 some plants out there, you know, and it's difficult. For me, because I like try to make it as basic as I can so that you'll learn it as quick as you can.
Uh-huh.
And I get very pushy that way. I'll go, no, no, it's not a food. Just forget it. Just forget it. It's not a food. Now, botanists, their hair curl when I do all that. But I do that because I'm trying to get across just those foods. So by the end of that hour's walk, everybody goes, oh, there's whatever, oh, there's whatever, oh, there's whatever. Because it's just, these things are just all over the place. And that's my goal, that you're always safe. You've got the few that you will definitely remember, and you should go home and cut up and spice up and eat them. Make flour out of a lot of things. That's led to a whole new world. I don't know why the Native Americans never did that. They made flour out of corn, but not the wild plants. I can find no evidence of that. I find the Europeans did, if they were stuck, like George Washington was stuck in Valley Forge.
Mm-hmm.
If the Europeans were stuck, they did pulverize some of these same wild foods to flour and make bread. But as a rule now, it was not a standard way of life for the Iroquois to make pita cakes, you know.
Uh-huh.
For me, it's muffins and pancakes and waffles.
Did you have to acquire a taste for a lot of these?
Yeah. Yes. You should never start out full, like a total clover pancake, for instance. It would be too strong for the uninitiated. It should be like a half a cup of clover to 2 cups of regular whole wheat flour or whatever. And the book tells you all that.
Okay.
It gives you all the ways to do that.
And one of the reasons why I started out probably about 18 or 19 years old trying to get some interest in areas around what you covered. But when you described your experience in the Adirondacks.
That's it. I was like, it was like made to have to learn it. Well, I mean, I walked it down 9 miles and back with a 50-pound pack. And I did that, stupid me, for I don't know how many months, probably a year. And that was ridiculous to say, oh, where does spaghetti sauce go? Or, you know, is that gone? And we didn't have any refrigeration either. And it was so crazy to stand there in the middle of all these beautiful green trees and plants and wonder what you could eat, what you couldn't. And interesting enough, I always wanted to teach it. And my ex-husband, and he's an ex-husband, he said to me, if you're going to teach this, then you're going to learn the hard way. And I'll never forget that. You have to figure out which ones you can make, which ones you can eat and which you can't. And that's how those foraging rules came about. I knew you could eat clover or strawberries or, you know, those kind of things. But blackberries, raspberries, I knew you could eat that, but I didn't know you could eat the bark of those things. I didn't know you could shred the bark off and make a very wonderful stir fry. I had a shredded bark and garlic, wild garlic, oh my gosh, you can make like what the Egyptians do out of sow thistle and wild lettuce. They chop it up real fine and they add onion. And I've talked to men who do this, their wives do it. And they sometimes have eggs, sometimes they don't. But if they have an egg, they will put an egg in it to bind it tighter. And they'll make like what you call a wild lettuce hamburger. In all sincerity, it's the most delicious thing you've ever had in your life. It's got a veggie burger mix, you know, by a mile. It's absolutely delicious. And you can buy that in restaurants in Egypt. Turkey does that a lot, cuts things fine. Adds olive oil, onion, and fries it.
Now, was this meatless?
Huh?
Was this a meatless burger?
It's like a thin hamburger.
Uh-huh.
You know, in height and breadth, and it's quite clay-like if you cut it small enough.
Uh-huh.
If you cut the leaves small enough, you can actually squish them together. And if you bind them with onion and an egg, you've got it made.
Okay, then it's meatless then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I've been vegetarian for how long? 45 years now? Something like that. In the very beginning, my son saw me kill a rabbit. I had hunted and trapped for a while, and actually, I did enjoy it, but it took hours to do all this all day, and I had 100 other things to do. And he worked for a log mill, so I knew when he got home at 5, he was starving. And, you know, and the boy would get back from school, so, I mean, I had to really scurry to get a whole meal, you know, not just a pot with greens in it, which was my staple at all times. But I had to figure out the other recipes that are in the book there. And they came about quite naturally because, you know, you're using something for something else, like daisies. Daisy petals were my son's very favorite. Daisy petals make the neatest popsicles. And in the winter, we'd make popsicles. It doesn't make sense, but we did because you could make them then and just stick them outside in a cup, and it would freeze, and he'd love that. And I'd stuff it full of things like dried rose petals or daisy petals or something fun, berries, that type of thing. And I soon learned that if you can eat the petals, maybe you can try the leaves. I'll tell you, Melody, if you were to eat a Shasta daisy petal right now out of your garden, you would not believe it. Of course, to me, it was like gold because it was like, wow, what a taste. What a taste that is. It's so absolutely wonderful. It was just so startling to find that leaf because it was so different. Wasn't spinach-like, and it wasn't vegetable-like. It was its own thing. When I found chamomile, it was such a godsend because the taste of cutting up that... I mean, I didn't mind if it was a real chamomile or the pineapple weed. I would cut it up and make a side dish out of that. Kids love that.
I can see using it as herbs a lot of times, but trying to make a whole meal.
Yeah, but not as food, but it is. This is the thing. Mint, for instance. Mint has enough iron in it to have your whole 100-milligram tablet a day, but you have to, like, not eat one leaf in the decoration. What you need to do is get used to using mint as gum during the day, and chew 4 or 5 mint leaves and put it right up over your lip, just like a baseball pitcher. And that was our gum for the day. Any mints. Spearmint. You knew they had square stems, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the square stems.
Isn't that funny? I mean, I just thought, I think that's the most amazing thing. I just heard somebody that the other day. It was a cook, a very gourmet cook, who does some meals for friends of mine. And I said, you knew they had what? They don't. I said, yeah, they do. All mints do. So I never, ever, ever even had to question I was doing right when I would find a bed of a certain kind of mint. And I was always thrilled because I could spend 15, 20 minutes. And I always carried, this is all in the book and stuff, you know, but I always carried rope or string with me. In 2 or 3 foot sections, and I'd stuff them in my pocket, my dungaree pocket. Because if I came across a bed like that, I would rope a big wad on the end and then another wad further in, about 6-8 inches in the rope. I'd come out of the woods with this whole green rope of food, and I used to go in and harvest like that. And I still teach people how to do that. Because, say, for instance, you had to go out and collect. Now, this very second, oh, my gosh, I might be indoors for 2 days, okay? I mean, I'm just saying, hypothetically, which ones would you go after? Well, I'd be looking out my window here, and I'd see the pine tree, and that'd be the first thing I would do, is pine branches. I've already got enough in here in boxes, though, because we use them in tea for some of the lectures I still do. I still do some. I teach a group of survival children in COTEF, COTEF, Children of the Earth Foundation. And I just go over 2 or 3 times a summer, but there's 80 kids, and they live outdoors completely, absolutely. And they're taught all this by the instructors. and I've been doing this for 10 years or more with this group. And it's fantastic. They take in city kids and send them back completely fearless as far as food and how to build a shelter and that kind of thing. And but that we always teach them that pine branch, because that pine branch, all pines are edible. And I actually send you a whole sheet if you write me at P.O. Box 83, Shiloh, S-H-I-L-O-H, Shiloh, New Jersey. That's my post office box. Box 83, Shiloh, New Jersey, 08353. If you write me at that address, I will send you how to eat your pine tree. It's a sheet of paper that takes the needle all the way from sucking the juice from it, making tea out of it, making pine, popsicles, all that, to the very last thing is pine jello for children.
You know, one of my favorite smells in the world is breaking a pinion branch.
Have you gathered pinion nuts? I've never talked to anybody who has.
No, I have gathered lots of pinion nuts.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yes. No, I.
Where
I
were you? In Flag? Or?
I mean, they're all around me. So it took a little bit to, I was, for years I lived here, and I had some pinion trees outside my house, and this little Spanish lady came to my door one day and asked if her and her granddaughter could pick the nuts from underneath my tree.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even know they were there, and she got this big coffee can full, and she gave us some of the nuts, and after that, she got me started, and now when I go for walks, I can spend,
look
whole afternoon.
Look how expensive they are. I mean, my gosh,
I love them.
I mean, you're lucky to be doing that and having that, because they're one of the highest sources of protein you can do.
And, one of the things I found, too, is you can if I'll soak them in water, if they're starting to dry out, they'll turn around and they'll keep longer.
Yeah. I mean, I dry them only because I have them longer for, stored away type thing. But everything that we're talking about is reconstituted in water.
Okay, let me go ahead and say this is KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And my guest this evening is Linda Runyon, and her website is ofthefield.com. And we are talking about all kinds of wild things growing around us that can feed us. So you were talking about these survivalist gatherings.
Now, I hate to use that word because I know what that does. Two people, they separate, I'm calling the groups across this country that do such a wonderful job teaching all this. I'm more or less calling it the hunter-gatherer organizations.
Uh-huh.
Because that's really what it is. They're teaching prehistoric skills. They're the most professional people you've ever met in your life, in businesses and everything. But they are experts. Some of these men I have met, you just cannot believe the expert skills that they have on what they are teaching. I mean, they can walk into any place whatsoever. Oh, my gosh. Well, Willie himself, he can build a fire in less than 30 seconds. Anywhere. I don't care if it's pouring rain. The man can do it.
Well, I'd love to go to something like that. I was just wondering if there's a name that some of them have and where you can go find them.
Oh, yes, there is, and I'll be sure from now on that, because I constantly get the schedules and stuff, I'll be sure to get it to you.
Okay, great.
You'll be able to, I could email them to you.
Okay, great.
And you can get them out to the people, too. But you know where you can go to get most of this information is go on holotop.com.
Holotop.com.
Holotop.com lists all the schools in the country. All of us are in there. Okay? It's a website where you can get a ton of information like this from one end of the United States to the other. So wherever you live, you're going to find your teacher or your school or your hunter-gatherer group.
So you're saying that there's a lot of people that do have interest in it then that are teaching it and doing things along the line that what you're doing. Is that okay?
Exactly. Our thinking is 99% on line with each other. Okay. And the reasons are all the reasons. If we can eliminate fear with our skills, that job done. We've done it.
And
that's how we feel.
When I was going through your works that you'd sent, one of the things that kind of crossed my mind a little bit was when you lived, you lived primitively, and
yeah,
I couldn't even imagine living in the cold like that for such long periods of time.
You're so used to it. It was unbelievable. And things I couldn't do today. I mean, Melody, if I were to do it today, I'd have to go through the whole gamut. Of course, being 73 would make a big difference, but I'd have to go through the whole gamut of learning to turn things off and intense cold and heat and such, because you have to.
Right, right.
I mean, there's men right down the way I noticed doing a roof today. It's 94. Now, those men have found that portion of them that can turn off that intense heat on top of them shingles. Well, then I doubt they've learned that part. And I'm not trying to say anything, but like, you already own these things, right? They're in your yard, or they're right down the way, or you have a field down the way, or something. And it boggles my mind that we don't take advantage of what is free.
Well, one of the things that I was going to ask you is when you were talking about this being real primitive, I was surprised that you lived so primitive for so long. Was that done on purpose, or was that done from economic means? Or it didn't seem like you added that much comfort type items.
Exactly, I did not. And unfortunately, we look back, that we didn't. But if we got too comfortable, because a couple of times I remember being in what I called complete comfort, motel, car broke down type thing. To do that was to open up all these doors in your head of how, I can't even describe it. This is the easy life we have. It really is. It's, I can say that quite honestly, that anyone that's listening probably, except for a lot of my customers write me and tell me they have to walk 3 miles to the post office. They're the guys that I do know that are closer to what I did, or they'll have no electricity. They'll write me from the post office. I don't know how to tell you, there's a different way of thinking. Time is not the same. From the time you wake up, that sun coming through is like different. It's different. Our my whole day is different now. Writing and going on the computer, and I guess I could almost write something about that, but I don't know how. I won't get real deep about it, but you could take. Well, let me not get deep and talk about Europe. In Europe, if you go around the countryside, you're gonna see people gathering food. How come they're doing that and we're not? Make it that simple. How come they know all that and we don't? That's where I go and almost get angry. I mean, I have the extreme. I have the extreme and don't. For any second, think I'm teaching somebody to go extreme. God help us if we ever do, really, because we're not. I'm not. I'd have to go all the way back again in learning everything again. How to be uncomfortable again.
Well, do you still incorporate that in your diet, though? A lot of the.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I pick my salad. This morning, early with the dew on it, it's all picked. That was simple. It took me 2 minutes. Do you know how I do it now? So I don't even have to leave. I can continue to write here. I grow it. I grow it in window boxes. I have big stashes of wild lettuce and dandelion and clover, and you can get seeds. I think my website has links to like Bountiful Gardens. Bountiful Gardens has probably 17 of my wild foods. They actually will send you the most beautiful, and they're the proper seeds. They're not the I'm not an expert on this. It's HMO. They're the good ones. They're the good natural
GMOs.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm bad on all that because I'm not keeping up with what's happening today too much. I'm doing as much as I can. But they have the good ones. That's all I know. So I'm going to put them on, if they're already up on, not on the links on my website, they will be because we're going to be redoing that shortly.
Well, I once heard, you know, some of those wild plants kind of follow humans around and that some of them have deep tap roots. It's kind of like nature's way of bringing the nutrients back to the upper ground because they would go reach deep into the earth and bring that up.
Yeah.
And one of them, like the dandelion, now I've seen it in grocery stores where the leaves are really pretty large.
Big and long.
And my understanding, when my mother was telling me about, you know, eating dandelions, she would always get the young ones.
That's right. And I always wished I had enough money to take them and analyze them. Because I'm wondering, because like five leaves out there on the lawn, wild, okay, small leaves, tap roots maybe 3 inches long, they are natural, and I've had them analyzed, and I know what's in that half cup. You've got 2-3 glasses of milk in calcium in a good cup of the wild dandelion leaves, and the roots are high in nutrition. There's whole books just written on how to eat a dandelion, the wild one now. So you buy the ones there, and I'm wondering if that one leaf is equal to, in vitamins and minerals, that one leaf now, those 5 or 6 dandelion leaves that we analyzed. I don't know. I have no idea. Are they like the iceberg lettuce where there's very little nothing in there, just a bunch of fiber? I don't know, Miller.
Dandelion's supposed to be real high in sodium, and that's one of our most most of us don't have enough sodium in our body, believe it or not.
Yeah, because we stopped eating. Doctors have said don't eat salt. That was one of my problems one time, and they found out that was one of my problems I had not had. So I started eating more of the plants I knew had sodium in it. You say sodium, yeah, there's 76 milligrams in a half a cup. In my book here, 76 milligrams of salt in a half a cup of wild dandelion leaves.
You know, my understanding is, see, that's more of an organic, natural sodium, not sodium chloride.
Right.
And there's a difference there. What is your favorite?
My favorite of all?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Probably milk thistle. Milk thistle is the most buttery. It's like eating butter. It's like eating a stick of butter. So it's not everywhere, but it is in every state. Okay, it's in hot spots, hot areas. Desert has got a lot, you know, a lot more than here. You have it. I know you do. We have it, but it's far and few between. You can grow it from milk thistle seeds, gotten. As I do, and it you have tons of it. But it doesn't produce like dandelions, you know. It has one big stem in the middle. It's got a big, gorgeous purple artichoke top to it, and the leaves can get up as big as 2 feet long. And they have barbs on them that look so lethal that you would not want to touch it. I mean, seriously. So I usually do like whole classes just on thistles. And I take a pair of scissors, literally, and trim that leaf. And then I cut it off with a long pair of tongs or a long handled knife, that one leaf, and you turn it over. It's got a vein on the back, and you can hang on to that vein. It's protruding. Mm-hmm. You can hang on to that. It's like an inch out. And you can handle it just like a fan. You know, it's quite amazing. Mm-hmm. And I've cut the barbs off, right? So I cut it into strips. And I cook that one big leaf, and that will give me a really nice vegetable portion, but it goes down like butter. I cannot describe the consistency. And that has that silymarin in it.
Uh-huh.
That for the for your liver. And you know, that's really good for you. That's to me putting in a lot more than spinach, and there's no doubt where I got it from.
And you also mentioned, now don't they have the fluffy stuff, the milk thistle?
Yeah, the tops, those mm-hmm. artichokes have that beautiful purple fluff.
Uh-huh.
I eat that like it's gone out. I hate to take the whole thing. I take like half, and then it'll produce more.
Interesting.
And that's solid. You could farm one of those plants. Just take half of that big, beautiful thing, and then the rest of it will fill in again. And you can do that all summer long. It has to go to seed, so it has to continue that process.
So when you were gathering, you always made sure you left some things behind.
Always. Right. Always. I've been known to, you know, I sort of bless the plants like I'm in another world, you know, because, I mean, I don't know. It's, most of my time I was there. I call it in the light type thing. The type of living became that. And I do miss that, and I do seek it constantly out there, picking in the morning and at night.
I want to go back to the pine a little bit, since I'm kind of got it all around me. Were there some that were more tasty than others?
Yes, absolutely. There again, different recipes for different folks. Different. You use it in a certain way. If it's more nutritious than the next one and you don't care for the taste as much, dry it. Make a powder out of it. I have all these little jars on my stove, and each one of them, I take a teaspoon of something according to what I'm doing. If I'm making, let's say I'm making pasta sauce, I just throw in a teaspoon of this and a teaspoon of that. And you can put a teaspoon, let's say, of the book covers all this, by the way, and mm-hmm. so the DVDs. You can take a teaspoon of these things. I call them
nutritious.
They're additives, nutrient additives.
Okay.
Okay, little jars. I collect, like, baby food jars like an insane woman, you know, and I fill them up. Because this way, the tastes are all different. I mean, seriously, all different. I remember one time I worked with the Biosphere. Did you hear that, Melody?
No.
The Biosphere was at City Under Glass in Tucson.
Uh-huh.
And they asked me to be a consultant that had to do with the wild foods, because they were bringing in hundreds of plants from all around the world, and they were sterilizing them, sterilizing the soil, excuse me. All the plants from all the different countries were used for different things in this City Under Glass, all for research purposes, so that the astronauts, they called the scientists that went in, were proving that certain ones would be good in space, certain ones wouldn't. You know, there's a million reasons why they did this. And the research will go on for years, like the Hubble telescope is going to go on for years. But it did close, and it closed 2.5 years in. You can go for a wonderful tour in Tucson, and do, if you're out that way, go to the Biosphere for a tour. It's just an awesome sight to see this monstrous building out of glass. Monstrous, and inside is a synthetic ocean, synthetic lake. You know, everything has been done as real as possible, as if you were on another planet. And I think it's amazing to go take a tour of it. So, but the red ants, spiders, the real bad ones. I had them in my apartment all the time. The black widows.
Uh-huh.
They just forced them right out of there. I mean, everything that went in there was supposedly sterilized.
Uh-huh.
And bird population, everybody that went in there was, like, put up for months and years ahead and all this kind of stuff. So that the normal germs were not put in there normally. Well, the only thing that they forgot was that the weeds, okay, I told them, you can't sterilize against this nature. You can't. You just can't. So there's just no way it's going to happen. And, you know, they were scientists, and I'm not arguing with them at all, but the weed growth was astronomical. That's what you see today when you go. you know, all these things grew anyway. So you got the wild lettuce and you got the, you know, the dandelion and this kind of thing in the areas that were sustaining wonderful other edibles that some other area in the United States might, or the world might be eating for food. So you couldn't keep it separate. Nature took over.
I don't even see how they could keep the insects out of
sorts. Well, they wouldn't use any insecticides or pesticides or anything like that. They're wonderful. It was wonderful what they did, but gee whiz, I just knew it wasn't gonna. It just wasn't gonna work, because you know how the weeds grow. I mean, I'm always saying they were growing lettuce. For instance, I have photos of everything, and for those years that we did that, and I took photos of the food that they were growing, and they were growing lettuce for outer space without soil.
Uh-huh.
It's just incredible, the root system, you know, how they spray. It was all automatic. And if they were to have done purslane, or the only plant they did do in there was amaranth, Hopi red amaranth.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They made bread. They made everything imaginable out of the amaranth, as is in my book. Also, because amaranth is one of my plants that, you know, that I ended up with. It's everywhere in every country.
Mm-hmm.
And they did go in with amaranth seeds or plants, I think, probably. And they sustain themselves pretty much with that, because it's so, that particular plant is just got so many vitamins and minerals in it that if you made a loaf of bread out of it, just as is, you know, without whole wheat flour, just as is. Amaranth bread. Remember we sold that in the stores?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, you know, people didn't really, it didn't catch on. I don't even think you can find it now. We can't around our area because we've looked.
I think we've got it.
We don't have it here. I think we do in a health food shop up in Vineland, which is the distance from me.
Mm-hmm.
But in your average stores, you don't get amaranth anything now. It's too bad.
Well, there's
poor country, you know. So.
Right, but
yeah.
You know, we don't eat our. We go pay for food instead of picking it.
Right. Lots of times people say to me, "Well, we have a lot of acorns around us, so we would be fine." And I would tell them the story of the trying to live from acorns. So we did that, been there, done that. We couldn't crack the darn things to put them in the streams to leach them out. We used sheet metal in a truck. And tried to crack them back. We ran over them and ran over them. We still didn't get half of them open enough to be able to put them in the burlap bags, to put them in the stream. By the time we got done that, my brain did another 380, I called it. And my brain says, why are we doing this? Why, because you say you could live off it. This is a waste of time. So, I mean, my prehistoric is the word I jokingly throw out, but my hunter-gatherer friends make acorn things, wonderful acorn cakes. They teach classes on how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so time-consuming. It's like getting the cattail root. I mean, I tried it in a swamp, and I'm good with a bow saw, but not that good. I could never get a nice section cut. Yeah, in a mucky swamp, I finally thought, well, why aren't we eating the tops that I can get to? And so my material I ended up with after these 26 years here is definitely the easiest way. I just need you to know that.
Okay.
As hard as it might sound, in some instances, this is the easiest way, you know, because to me, it was a lot easier just to gather the leaves, let them dry. Now, yesterday, I gathered a whole bunch of violet leaves. They're growing everywhere out here. It took me 15 minutes, and I got a half a cup, probably close to a cup of flour out of it.
Uh-huh.
They dried in 2 days. It's 90-some degrees, and they're on trays crinkling. And when they crinkle, you know, the book tells you when it crinkles, and you can actually, you know, break it that way easy, then you call it dry, but it's not really. Before I actually put it away to store for 20 years, I will, in fact, take that, what I think is dry, and put it in glass that I've cleaned, and put it in an oven, or I don't use the microwave, but put it in the oven at 200 degrees, turn it off, and walk away. Mm-hmm. Then I go back and cap it up. So I don't put the lid on. I just put it at 200. All of this is in this stuff, you know.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, then I know that that's safe. It's not going to mold, and it's perfectly safe. It didn't destroy the nutrition at all in there. And then when I run out of nutrient additives, got it out right that time, then I got another baby food jar full of it.
Uh-huh. Now, are junipers and spruces and the other varieties of evergreens just as edible, too?
Yes and no. I go by taste there. I know you can eat all the pine trees, but there's a couple that are a little bit strong next to white pine. I love white pine. And now the pinyon pine needles are a lot stronger than white pine needles. You can tell the difference in the taste of all the pine.
Uh-huh.
The different, yeah.
So you didn't eat the pinyon needles as much?
Not as much. I ate the pinyon nuts.
Okay.
Yeah,
and,
but see, we didn't have nuts in the Adirondacks. That's why I'm saying how lucky you are.
Well,
we didn't have them there. I found them in Flagstaff for the first time.
What I would, and I have not run across, I've bought pinyon oils, but it does not have the smell of what when you do a fresh pinyon.
Yeah, I know.
And it doesn't have that citrusy
smell
to it. And
it's definitely prepared, I call it, somehow.
Yeah, I that's my favorite smell.
Wow.
I just need to learn how to preserve it.
You know what's in that. I mean, what's in the nuts? Did you see what was in the nuts?
No, huh?
Here, I just had it out. This is what the we didn't eat the nuts, but we ate pine catkins. The catkins are the little extensions on the ends of all pine trees.
Uh-huh.
In the spring, that's where your needles are going to come out of.
They're much more tender.
Yeah.
All right.
We ate a couple of them a day, let's say.
Uh-huh.
Well, pine nuts are 634 calories for half a cup.
Wow.
And People Magazine didn't believe this. Martha Babcock, and she actually researched it in Manhattan in the big library there. And she came out with more calories than we had in our analyzation, which I thought was fun. They're 15.3 grams of protein. That's more than a hamburger.
Wow.
You know, so I have a nutrient additive bottle of pine nuts, and I will add them to a lot of recipes. They're 16.8 grams of carbs, and it's just incredible. They're over 9,800 units of niacin. I'm not a nutritionist, but I can tell you that's a lot of niacin. It must be, because that's the most.
Uh-huh.
Of all 52 plants, in my book, I think there's 55. There's three that aren't on the cards. There's nothing anywhere near that, 3,000 or 4,000 maybe. That's the highest. So your nuts are really, really good for you.
What?
Very good for you. And they're used well. They're used, you know, a little handful on fish or whatever. They're probably as good for you as the entire fish. I hesitate to say that, but that protein is probably close to it.
Now, you did some kind of, or did you gathering for, like, making soaps and things like that? Or
uh-huh, yeah. But sometimes it just didn't seem worthwhile. If it didn't come out right, I would always try things a certain length of time, like the goats and the cheese. It just didn't work out with everything else we had to do to continue to live like that. So, we scrubbed up with everything from sand, okay,
uh-huh.
to corn cockle, which is a bladder campion. It's that plant that looks like a bladder.
Huh.
That's all I can say. It's got a little fluted end to it. You can look it up. Now, I don't have it in my book because it's not a food. But when you crush up the flowers, and they grew prolifically, certain times of year they grew prolifically, and we gather a whole bunch of them without wiping out a field, for sure, and we throw them in a pot and put them over the campfire real low, you know, put them way out in the corner, and you could skim the green soap off the top. That was just wonderful. We use that for green soap. We use it for shampoo, too.
Uh-huh.
And so we did things like that. But actually making soap and cutting it and whatever, we only tried it once or twice. And it was just too many ingredients to get right and perfect. It was easier to take up a few bladder campion plants and have green soap.
Uh-huh. Do you think that if I say, like, someone wanted to go out and get started doing this, do you think that there's little groups and clubs or organizations that people can do on a local basis?
They're all over the place. Yeah. I wish I could just tell you. You've got to find them. Find them.
Uh-huh.
So you could. There's a newsletter out there, Wild Food. Now, we have a free newsletter, by the way. Our newsletter is free. You go on the ofthefield.com and sign up and have a free one every single month. But there is one that I swear by for that kind of information. And she gives where the feasts are and where the gatherings are and all that kind of stuff all over the United States. And especially the eastern and middle of the United States. And it's Wild Foods Forum. You can look it up on the website, Wild Foods Forum, Forum.
Okay.
And you get her she just really keeps up with that. And that's probably a greatest thing, to get in touch with one of them. And then I bet within 30 miles or 40 or 50 miles from you, everywhere there's somebody. Now, they're all over.
Well, I did notice it seemed like I ran across an extension class that they were giving in our probably about 40 or 50 miles away, they were giving a class on something like that through the extension service.
Yeah, I was going to say colleges are having us in to do all sorts of stuff now. So that would be the way to do it. That would be the way. And networking, of course, as we all do in our businesses and everything, it happens real fast in this world because everybody is really interested in, and some are more interested in the curiosity of it or just eliminating the fear of food shortage or things like that. But I, for children now, if you have a family and kids, oh, my gosh. I mean, with we have a coloring book, by the way, and I should get this out now because it's important. My son, he named my whole enchilada, he calls it. And now, I didn't name it. He did. Okay. I still have trouble. I'm laughing just talking about it. But the WEP, the whole enchilada, is everything I've written. It takes in everything. It takes in. If you were to get everything on that website called the WEEP, you would get the field guide, the deck of cards, the DVD, the Survival Acre, the original field guide, a coloring book, note paper free. You would get patterns for how to build a drying rack in your house free. You would get Homestead Memories, all those stories, free. And it all comes with that one. On our website, we have sale packages, and that's the biggest package.
Right, and that was reasonably priced for everything that was included in that. And
it takes everything.
How many hours is on your DVD?
Three.
3 hours?
From 52 hours, so we really jammed that thing.
So is that a demonstration of what these things look like and what to do with them? Or
yes. He took each and every plant off the deck of cards, and you see a perfect picture of it, and then I just take off sort of like we're doing, only in great depth on each plant. And then during my talking on each plant, he is a researcher in his own right, and for instance, like burdock root, I was talking about burdock and how he made candy out of the root and did all these different things. He researched it further with pictures from, I think it's either Japan or Korea, and I'm not sure, to be honest with you. Somebody can let me know what I see there. But he has pictures of people chopping the roots and doing all these things, which he has researched off the net. So he's done a lot with permission, a lot of pictures off the net, to verify what I'm saying, which is good in different countries.
And the pictures on your cards are in color, correct?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Because that was the hardest thing that I've run across when I was looking for books, was finding color pictures so that, because drawings, it doesn't help me with drawings.
I understand 100%. I 100%, because I tried in the beginning to do the drawings, and we move right further from that to most people can't. I'll tell you one book, Stephen Brill's book. Oh, my gosh, he's a botanist, okay? And he does your New York City walk. And he does the most exquisite drawings you'll ever see in your life. I honestly, years ago, they had what they call the Linda Friggin retreat-type place in Warrensburg, New York. And it was great. Business people bought a big, big building, and I was able to do my very heart's worth there, because they said, every room in there, you do what you want with it. Well, my gosh, I had a root room, a tree room, a leaf room, you name it. It was absolutely incredible. And I only had the cards and the book, the original Survival Acre then, and some pamphlets. But we put thousands of people through that. I mean, it was just totally amazing. The interest was amazing. And that's when I met Stephen, because he actually, you know, he was already giving tours in New York, in Central Park, and he came up to stay at the Institute. We called it the Runyon Institute. And he came up to stay at the Wild Food Museum. And during that time, he did some of the drawings for his latest book, which is, I've never seen drawings like that. The man has my rapidograph drawings beat by a mile. He's just incredible. He's an incredible artist.
Wow.
Just to let you know, Stephen Brill, and you could go on his website. He's written many books, too. He's a botanist. So he has a botanical way of seeing these plants. And some people prefer that from my way.
So you didn't get into the medicinal aspects of many of these, I take it.
Just what's common, Melody.
Okay.
Just the common, you know, you could read in any book that yarrow is a stimulant and a diuretic and this kind of thing. I only did that, and because I'm not licensed,
right,
to be honest with you, and I needed to just concentrate on the food. It takes in the medicinal. I mean, if you eat it, you're eating your medicine.
Right.
So, you know, if you read, you know, clover this and this and that, and then it gives you all the medicinal aspects of it. Well, if you're eating a half cup of that, you had your medicine for whatever it says. And that's been my approach.
What was your son's favorite growing up?
Oh, my. Very gourmet. Oh, my goodness sakes. Lamb's quarter quiche type thing.
Now, is that one that you got to pick young, too, or is it? Or better young, or
most everybody who would teach us would be weeping at my patio right now. I have lamb quarters growing so thick that all I do is take a pair of scissors and shave it down. If I shave it down 6 inches, it pops right back up and grows back right back up almost immediately. I mean, within 4 days, it's right back where it started. They're weeds, and they just keep on growing. But I will have a cup of the most delectable lamb's quarter with butter on it. Oh, boy. That's my very favorite. I'm about ready to do it, too. I did it 3 days ago. And I see it's pressing against it. I have a screen over top of these things because of the squirrels.
Did you work any with some of the desert plants like rabbit brush or anything, or some of those?
I did, but only what was edible. They put me through a test one time in the biosphere, which I there's some things I'm very proud of, and that was the day when they had me come up. They wanted to test me and see whether I was genuine or not. And there was a room they had, a big, big greenhouse, full of 400 and some plants from all over the world. And all they did was walk with me with clipboards, and they said, you tell us which plants you would eat and which plants you wouldn't. And that was my test. and I am happy to say I passed that.
I
never heard of those plants in my life. I couldn't tell you one name of those plants, those bushes, those shrubs. But I can tell you, if you pick a leaf and you smell it and you link to it, I call it, and I know this sound. Did you see Avatar?
Not yet. I've got it.
Oh, well, when you see it and you see the link, that's all I'm going to say. You see the connection between them and any form of nature that's alive. You'll see what I'm talking about. There's no way I can explain it. I know. I can tell. I don't know how I can tell. I don't know if I could do it now. If you took me right now and drove me into a same situation, I doubt I could go through. Well, we quit at the fourth row of these big eight-foot-long tables, a great big greenhouse. We quit at about 100 plants because she said, well, I'm tired. I don't know about you. And that was that. Then they tried to get a grant for a wild food grant in Phoenix for me to do a walk of wild food plants. And we couldn't get the grant. I was sort of only known to certain groups of people, I guess. And I don't have a PhD type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we couldn't get the grant. With their help, they wanted to get a grant, and they couldn't do it.
So when you're talking about this link thing, is it kind of like this plant speaking to you?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, in the greatest way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And I mean, I literally do believe that there is such a thing.
Melody, I'll say this, and I know I'm on the air. Absolutely, there is such a thing. To become one with that other living thing is that link. And the only way we teach kids is to blindfold them. This is what we do in our camp. We'll be doing this next week. You blindfold them. You sit them around a plant that's in a pot. You sit them around clover or strawberry or mint or whatever. They're just the good ones, you know, the ones that can handle, not the nettles, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they're blindfolded. There's four on a plant. You know, it's like 60 kids. And they commune with that plant. Now, some children really commune with the plant. I can tell from the questions they ask. When the four sitting around a plant that has the four sides instead of round, the mints, and they'll jump up, 6 years old, and they'll go, that has a square stem. But that has a square stem. They felt that plant. They communed with that plant.
Mm-hmm.
They smell it. They're feeling it. They're really analyzing it. And we ask them to analyze it in every way they can.
Now, can they pick out whether it's the stem or the leaves or the root or berries or whatever.
And that's what they do.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. To watch them blindfolded go over a plant is, to me, the greatest, greatest way to introduce a child to a plant before they ever see it or know a thing about it. Let them. And that's all she did with me. Was let me go in that. Oh, except she kept moving me along. Okay, that's enough. Because I would say, okay, because I know the smell is good, that does not mean, you know, I would have to put it through my foraging rule where I crushed it and got it juicy and put it over my gum and waited 20 minutes. This is the proper thing for us to do.
Uh-huh.
But I knew that I couldn't use certain plants immediately just from the smell, just from the feel of them, that they were, I don't know how I knew. I don't know if I could do it today.
Yeah, but some of your bitter plants are still, I mean, some of them are medicinal, even if they're not necessarily, I mean, could you pick
that's
them
right.
out?
Certainly. Uh-huh. And that's for the experts, like Susan Weed.
Okay.
Or, yeah, Rosemary Gladstar. These are my friends who are the experts in that.
Okay.
But that's what they do. So either you want the herbal. Maybe you learn. Maybe you go to a teacher like myself that is going to teach you the survival way of those plants. But then you go to an herbalist, and you're focusing on detail that you just never even realized, or just because of the medicinal aspects.
Uh huh. Which those, but of course those grow around you too, because I once watched a video, and actually have a video of Dr. Christopher, where he, when he would go in to treat somebody, he'd just go out in the yard and pick the plants.
I know quite a few people studying his way.
Right, and he's not the only one like that, but I'm sure, and your Native Americans and other peoples had to do the same thing. And it was just interesting.
I think my way came about more because I was like spirited into a 12-foot of snow and a and a log cabin in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was a whole different thing.
Right.
Than they were doing in their experience. You know.
But you had to treat yourself for when you were ill too, didn't you?
Oh yeah. No, yeah. He took the end of his finger off of the. Chancel one day, and that I knew we were really being tested that day. So I always had a pouch of Solomon seal. False Solomon seal has a root that all the books said it coagulated blood. Okay,
uh-huh.
I had never tested it, but that's what they said. So I gathered those roots and I strung them on necklaces, as the Iroquois did. They had them in their teepees and they had them in their different spots that they frequented it a lot, so they always had that as a something they could grab and pound with a rock and use it.
We used it
when he took the tip right off. And you know what, I mean, I'm not saying that it outdoes anything of medical science, but we had 60 miles to go
right
in medical science, so it worked just fine for us that day.
So what was it, your parents that made you leave the Adirondacks, or just
when Mom fell and broke her hip, my brother took care of her with his wife, but she fell and broke her ankle. That was one thing. Then she slipped by the pool with her crutches and broke her wrist, and that poor girl, it was just too much on them, going back and forth in traffic. 8 million people and stuff with Mom and Dad. And we had the both of them. And he called me, and they got word to me. And that was it. That's how I left the woods.
So they had moved from the East Coast to Arizona.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
so it was desert from that second on. You know, that was like, oh, dear, I just got done, and I'll say this out and mean every word of it. I wore suntan lotion back then when I went out on the desert.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't do any good. I mean, to tell you, I was out on the desert so much. I God knows where I'd be today if I hadn't done that. Okay? But I spent hours out in that blazing sun. You can't do that today. You just really can't, the blonde person. Mm-hmm. I just got done a facial peel for the amount of cancer on my face, and it was all from those 13 years out there.
Uh-huh.
So it's gone, thank goodness. But I would say to everybody, but there was Melody, there was a group of Girl Scouts down at the local grocery store selling cookies, and I went up without, I forgot about my face and how bad it looked, but it was being treated, right? I didn't think about it, and I went to buy some whatever it was I got, and to donate to them, the woman said, oh, what's, I said, oh, I'm not communicable or anything. I said, I'm having a facial peel. And right away, I looked right down at the six, being the incurable teacher. I looked down at the six kids, and I said, where are your suntan lotion, girls? Because I didn't, and I got boo-boos because of it.
Well, you didn't wear a hat?
Huh?
You didn't wear a hat?
Yeah. But that sun at 100 goes on that desert sand, goes right back up on your face, just like you were
really?
In a tanning booth.
Really?
Under
wow.
your hat. Mm-hmm.
I never even thought of that.
Oh, yeah. It's like a, mm-hmm. Yeah, you live under air conditioning out there. Anybody would tell you in the summer.
No, I've gone to some visits out there when it's been 115, and knew of people that would even venture out to try to walk in that, which
that's, That's right. Because in 20 minutes, you can dehydrate all the way down.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we're getting to the point where is there any subject you'd like to cover here that maybe we hadn't? And if there is, go ahead.
Oh, my. Oh, my. That's fantastic for you to give me that. I don't know where to go with it. I really, really don't. Write me if you want. I will say this again. At Box 83, Shiloh, Shiloh, New Jersey, 08353. And ask me questions. If you're not computer literate, on the computer you can't reach me. You really can't. It's all technical on there. You won't get me directly, but it will tell you to write P.O. Box 83, Shiloh, and I'll be happy to answer anything. Some people have pressed a leaf sample of plants they're wanting to know a certain thing about. That's okay. Be sure it's pressed real well. I will tell you, and I hope some of my friends aren't listening, Melanie, because they sent me like the whole plant, you know. Uh-huh. They will rot in plastic when they come through from another state, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I can't tell what it is at all. All I see is mold. So you can't do that. You have to dry it. You have to, like, put it between the pages of a telephone book, please, if you send me a sample. But if you want your whole lawn done or something like that, ask me first, and I might charge you a little bit for that. Send a self-addressed envelope if you have a lot of things that you want me to send back. Like, if you want a bunch of catalogs, it would be nice if you sent me a self-addressed envelope on that. And because we don't do that on the web, you will get a catalog on the web automatically with anything that you get. And sign up for the free newsletter. And I just don't know what to say. Contact Mother Earth, because the further we get away from it, the worse it is for us, and we all know that.
Well,
and all the answers are there. It's just so wonderful, I think, to be able to spend, even if it's 10 minutes on your coffee break, and go outside. They're truckers, I know now, that are eating their lunch on the sides of the road. They go down in, over 100 feet down in a ravine. They just take oil and vinegar in a container now. I got photos. They mail me some photos and stuff. Really?
Well, you know, I haven't heard yet that they're making GMOs out of any weeds yet either.
So. I think it'll be a while since they've been refused and everything from the biosphere or the whatever, you know. And yet, take a trip to Europe, that's all I can say, if you can, and you'll see everybody doing that on the sides of the road. I'm always so happy when I see my Mexican friends gathering on the sides of the road. I got to talk to myself and make myself drive by, because I want to stop and I want to talk, you know.
Uh-huh.
But it's the most beautiful thing to see a family working together, gathering a field of something. It's just the most beautiful thing to me. It is what it's there for. And I don't know. It's
Well, you did mention something in some places where some of these plants are endangered or you may not be able to gather.
I could tell you a very quick story where people have written me that the fire hazards, they wouldn't let them eat their plants around the house because the guy let his field grow around the house and things like that. I ended up in my books giving you the answer to most of that. Just do a rototill section. That
mm-hmm.
rototill section, you would control it as if you had a nature's field. Honestly, all your chemicals and stuff you put on there is doing nothing but tracking in the house and giving it to you, whatever you're getting out like that.
Uh-huh.
So that's your choice if that's what you do. But if you want it to be at all natural, you just really have to stop that. And in a few years, it will clean itself out. Pick the highest spot in your yard to make your little swatch. And let it grow naturally, because that highest spot the water itself will leach down the chemicals that were there so that it has the least amount of chemicals is what I'm trying to say, on the top of a hill or the, you know, not the runoff section of your property, but the highest.
And is there a place that you can also get some of the seeds for some of these, in, just in case you don't have?
Absolutely, and that's what I'm doing in my older ages, working with senior citizens and people that have handicaps, and they can't get out and do this. The Bountiful Gardens is one, and Richter's, R-E-I-C-T-E-R-S, Richter's Seeds. They'll send you catalogs, and you can sit down with my deck of cards, for instance, and go through almost the entire deck. Between the two companies, they have almost everything. Almost everything.
Great, great.
Yep.
And a lot of it can be grown indoors.
Absolutely. I have lived on purpose. That's what the eighth book is, by the way, because I thought that's the thing that was missing. You know, all the people who can't, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get as much research as I can out in these last few years into this last book. And we build wild food identification walks. In the book, you'll see 11 in the Essential Wild Food Guide. And that's my premise, that every city within driving distance or walking distance has one single identification walk. Because if you have that, as we did in Glendale, and we put 3,000-4,000 people a week through it, you can see, survival-wise now, all your free food, all in a row, all
are you
being,
there?
You know, okay. Kept through sprinkler system or uh-huh. Whatever. I'm going to, my book will have all the ways from just a rock and doing it, you know, on the side of a barn to city, beautiful, gorgeous, with a museum-like house on the side that you can go through with, uh-huh. Like the Institute was.
Uh-huh. One other thing. Oh, gosh, my mind just went blank on it, too. on water. Now, do you water these much when they're naturally growing weeds and that sort of thing, or do you just let them go?
I let them go natural unless I honestly, like today it's 90. I may look at them tonight because it, sometimes it's questionable. I want to throw a cup of soda water on it, yeah, uh-huh. On each one of the long window boxes.
Okay.
And but I let them go natural 100% of the time. I have a problem when it rains too hard, too long. I really have to remember to go out in the morning and tip them. They get too much water.
Uh-huh.
So in the house, I've done this in the house, but that also takes care. Of watering and keeping it not too damp, you know, not so they don't damp off. Because you're cutting these things down, making them work hard for you.
Okay, and do you have, in any of your books, do you have any cactuses? Do you
yes.
Kind of look at, okay.
Yeah, there are three cactuses, Choya, Prickly Pear, and the Saguaro, which is not in every country, but Arizona really honestly did not look at my cards like they had those plants. It's such a mental thing in the summer when everything goes,
uh-huh.
Except what is on the middle of that desert. You got to look for a 2-inch seedling underneath something,
okay.
In the 120s.
Well, Linda, I want to thank you for a very interesting discussion, and I'm hoping that you will get some response from my community. And
oh wow, yeah. anyone from Colorado, I love that state. I've been to your state to the sheriff of Greeley County,
uh-huh.
To his house for a workshop. I guess he has mules. He teaches mule packs. That was quite a long time ago. It must have been 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I have been to Boulder.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a beautiful state. A lot of friends there. So I would be thrilled. Thank you very, very much for asking me.
And
is there any way I can get a recording of this?
Oh, yeah. This will be posted at www.givemesometruth.info, and it will air tonight. That would be from 9 to 11 or 11 to 1 your time.
Okay.
And that's at khen.org. And so I... And I hope, you know, we can do this again. So.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful day.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.